Well, now so. So, let's continue following this strategy, because that's what it is, path, strategy, a sequence of methods presented here in this manual of pith instructions by Pinchen Rinpoche. Now focusing, of course, on Vipassana, and specifically focusing on really understanding the nature of the self, how the self does exist and how the self doesn't exist, right? But the first part I found very interesting. I'm not sure I've seen it elsewhere. I continue to find it interesting. And that is this careful examination. We've done it, but it bears doing more than once, of examining the way we abide, right? In contrast to the mode of appearances, which we all know, we appear in very different ways. Even, you know, when I just look in the mirror sometimes, I see very different things, even from one day to the next. I see very different things. Not, you know, I don't mean anything mystical, it's just kind of like different. Older. Different. But even from day to day, I mean, I've just noticed that. You know, just I don't look the same, even from the morning to the afternoon. One thing I do know is I look the worst when I'm in a barber shop. I don't know why that is, but that guy staring back from the mirror is just pug ugly. Really. I've noticed that every time. I think there must be some kind of a special mystique in the barber shops to make you look ugly. I know I look the worst. Like, I don't even want to look. So, but that's the superficial. That's just visual impression, right? But then we know in more meaningful ways the myriad ways in which we manifest in the world. Well, very, very different. And ever-changing. Always changing. On the one hand, but in the contrast to that, the way of abiding, the way of being present, such that when I think back to my childhood, I have a sense of identity. That was me when I was a child. I see a photo of myself as a child, adolescent, and so forth. That was me. If someone right now should praise me when I was a teenager, when you were a teenager, you were such and such, I'd feel, oh, thank you. And if a person puts me down when you're in your 20s, she was so uptight, such a hard ass. I've been told that actually. When I was a disciplinarian in the monastery, well, my fellow monks told me, Alan, you have no idea, you are such a hard ass. Then I feel, oh. That's like 35 years ago, you know, but oh. Okay. So something abiding, some sense that you're referring to me, right? Appearance is very, very different. Child, young man, older man, etc. But what is abiding? So we examine that. It's worth coming back to and examining. Who are you? And what is it that bears that continuity that you identify, you recognize yourself? That's going to be really helpful to have a sense of that. That's not locked into this appearance or that appearance, but something that continues over time, that you say, yes, you're such and such a number of years old, and you were this, and you were this, and later you'll be this, and so forth, let alone in the bigger picture, you know, from lifetime to lifetime. You know, because highly realized beings will say, His Holiness Dalai Lama has said, when he was asked once, you know, it was in Australia, I heard, if any of you are here, you know, and I say anything incorrect, he was giving a talk, in some place in Australia, not in Melbourne or Sydney, someplace else. And it was a public discourse, I think many people there, of course. And someone raised the question, he said, Your Holiness, you refer yourself as a simple Buddhist monk and no realization, all of that. But sometimes we'd really like to be inspired by hearing about your actual realization. Would you be willing to be a bit more candid? And what I heard, it's a second hand, but what I heard, I said, well, you have a point. You have a point. Well, in that case, I can remember being with the Buddha. I can remember before that living in Egypt. After that, I can remember being a pundit in ancient India. So, yes. Were you there?
I remember the Egypt part.
Say again?
I remember the part about the Egypt.
Egypt. And what really brings me to tears, even when I say it again, I remember being with the Buddha. Oh, yeah, yeah. And so here is a person, you know, he is candid on occasion when he sees. It's like administering some really strong medicine. when he sees, okay, now's the time. He doesn't go around saying that. But when it's appropriate, it's not uniform, never tell, like it's some kind of a super secret. But it's also don't broadcast, don't highlight, don't try to impress people, you know. But he does on occasion. He is more candid. So here's a person who is now 80, soon to be 81 years old, and saying, I remember being there with the Buddha 2,600 years ago. I remember being in Egypt. And it's a sense of continuity, right? That was me in a previous appearance, right? So this is what we're really looking at. Now we can't, most of us don't have that ability, although I've met quite a number of people who I respect and really, you know, have great respect for, who do claim to have past life recall and show some real evidence of that. But let's set that aside for the time being, just within this life. I remember in a previous incarnation living in a little one-room apartment in the center of Göttingen, right across from the cathedral, and eating müsli and dried fruit and yogurt every day, and reading and meditating and smoking dope. I remember that, you know. Not me. He's not this one. I haven't smoked dope for a long, long time. But I remember that was me in an earlier incarnation. And so forth. And then the early times in Dharamsala, boy, very different. And so what is identifying? What is that common, that the one who abides? Because we're not speaking gibberish here. I mean, one can believe or not believe in reincarnation. To my mind, it's almost self-evident. But clearly, we are reborn every time we wake up in the morning. Clearly, we're reborn every time we slip into a new dream. And then we die from the dream, born into another dream, and then we die, and then we're born into waking state, and then we die, and we fall asleep, and so forth. So in this miniature, clearly so. So to make this short, because I want to get back to the text, what is it that abides? It's you. It's a person. And we're not talking about something that doesn't exist, because you do. You were a young man. You were a young lady. You were a girl, right? It's true. And there is continuity. And yes, that was. This is all meaningful speech. And so identifying what is it? Who is that person? What is the person who abides? And then seeing, it's really subtle. This is just, to my mind, brilliant phenomenology. And I don't recall having seen this. Glenn or Anna, you've read a lot, studied a lot. Have you seen that particular modality before in other texts? Examine your way of your neluk, Nangsul and Rang Zinsul, your way of being present, your way of appearing, and the way you apprehend. Have you seen that elsewhere?
Not in the way you're explaining
it. Yeah. And he says it just really simply, right there, but I think I'm just saying what it says in Tibetan. I'm not doing some special sin. Have you seen that? It's fascinating, isn't it? Because what I'm used to is identify the object of refutation, and they do parts, wholes analysis, do any of the myriad reasonings of Nagarjuna. Chandrakirti and so forth and so on. That's what I'm really familiar with. This one, it really does have that purely phenomenological flavor of Mahamudra, which is, I find just absolutely enchanting, you know. Like in the Insight chapter in Spacious Path to Freedom, I just adore that chapter because it's just so radically empirical, you know. It doesn't invite us to get caught up in head trips and just intellectual entertainment. Well, this is true here too. He's saying, examine closely, investigate closely. How do you appear to abide as you examine yourself? How do you appear to appear as you examine yourself? How do you apprehend yourself? This is radically empirical, right? But now we segue to the next meditation, which we're going to begin very shortly. You'll probably want to do that meditation more than once until we have a sense, this is what abides. This is what abides. And knowing that's not a delusional statement, you know. And then we go to this practice here. So I guided you earlier, basically just read Padmasambhava. You remember? It was right after he's finished settling the mind in its natural state. And he says, do this until you're finished, right? Don't be introduced to Rigpa too soon. And then he goes right to the next chapter, and in his Vipassana chapter, then the first stage was engaging in the search for the mind. Right? You've just settled your mind in its natural state. You've simplified it down to its raw core. its essential nature, right? So you see it unadorned, naked. That is, without the clothing of gender, age, ethnicity, personal history, and all that stuff, which is all fine. But if you really like to know that, if you really like to know the mind, you might want to just see it stripped clean of all the barnacles, all the stuff that's added to it, which can be taken away. When you strip it down to the substrate consciousness, you really can't just kind of pluck out. You can release gender, you can release ethnicity and all of that personal history. That's not a problem. You can go right beyond it. But when you come down to that crystal clear flow of sparkling water of your flow of awareness as you're resting in the substrate consciousness, self-illuminating, you can't pluck off anything. You can't take, well, let's see what it's like without the luminosity. Let's see what it's like without the cognizance. Well, then it's not there anymore. It's like looking at fire and say, well, let's look at the fire, but take out the heat. Then it's not fire anymore, right? That's what abides, right? What abides of you? Because there you are. You've been around for a number of years. You weren't born yesterday. What abides of you? And then we go to the next meditation. And we'll seek out, as he, Padmasambhava, all focusing on mind, says, now we engage in the search for the mind, right? And then pointing out Rigpa. That was the process, remember? The 1-2. Engaging in the search for the mind and the not finding, and then identifying what's left. Rigpa, pristine awareness, right? So identifying what abides, its manner of abiding, how does it abide? What is it that abides from day to day, decade to decade? That, at least we know what we're talking about. And some people, like His Holiness, know what they're talking about when they also said, as he'll say very gently, I feel a very strong affinity with the 13th Dalai Lama. Okay. And he'll say, I feel strong affinity with the 5th Dalai Lama. You know, well, read between the lines, you know, it's not too hard to figure out. But for the rest of us, ordinary people, or subordinary people, you know, like me, at least we know this. So having known that, let's go into the next practice. Okay? Good. Find a comfortable position. If we take this practice to heart, we really immerse ourselves in the meditation to follow, we will be going into uncharted territory. It can be frightening. And in order to continue the journey, to have the courage to continue the journey, it will be most helpful, if not simply indispensable, to have a very deep sense of refuge, deep sense of trust, of ease, of fearlessness. And we can meaningfully take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, in the Guru, the Yidam, the indivisibility of the Lama and the Yidam. All of this could be very meaningful. But on this path of Mahamudra, this path of Dzogchen, the final refuge is, of course, not to look for the Buddha outside yourself, but to take refuge in the Buddha within, in your own pristine awareness. So taking refuge, arousing the motivation of bodhicitta, It's subtle body, speech, and mind in the natural state. This process finally culminates, of course, in simply resting in awareness, simple and unadorned, free of elaborations. We see this awareness very nakedly, without mediation, when we've achieved shamatha, and as Padmasambhava, the Lakeborn Vajra, says at the culmination of his teachings on shamatha, now you see the essential nature. The essential nature of your mind. The essential nature of consciousness. And then where you proceed to vipassana. So now briefly review, as you examine the way you abide, the way you appear, and the way you apprehend yourself. What is your essential nature? You that abides, continues over time. Who are you? How do you apprehend yourself? Examine closely. Bear in mind, the person you're attending to here does exist. The essential nature of fire is that it's hot and burning. That doesn't mean it's inherently existent. It just means this is true of fire wherever it is. It's an abiding constant. However fire may appear in this situation or that, this is the abiding element. The mind appears in a myriad of ways, but the abiding element, that which persists over time, that sheer luminosity and sheer cognizance. So you too, as an individual, a person, you too abide over time. You too have an essential nature. The person you are, who wakes up and falls asleep, who grows old. Who are you? What is your essential nature? How do you abide? engage in a task which psychologists call the exercise of working memory, where you bring something to mind. It could be a mathematical equation, it could be a design for a new dress, it could be travel plans for going on vacation, it could be anything. Bringing something to mind, holding it in mind, and then engaging in a task while doing so. So we're all novices in this practice, but do your best of your ability as a beginner. Hold in mind, bring to mind, hold to mind. The person, this abiding person, the person who abides over time. Bring this person yourself to mind. Hold it in mind. Now remembering it, direct your attention now to the space of the body. You're very familiar with this, we've done it many times before. Direct the light of your awareness to the space of the body, identify it. It is, of course, the space, the domain, or the field in which this whole array of tactile sensations, tactile feelings arise and pass. Holding in mind the person you apprehend yourself to be, the one who abides. Examine firsthand the arisings of the earth element, indicated by sensations of firmness and solidity throughout the body. And look for a match. Among these various manifestations or emergences of the earth element throughout your body, are any of these a match for the person that you are who abides over time? Are any of them equivalent, identical with you? Simply manifestations of the earth element, empty of any person, devoid of any personhood. Examine so closely that you come to certainty. There should be no ambiguity about this. Then moving fairly quickly, examine the manifestations within the somatic field of the water element, moist, fluid, the fire element, warmth, heat, the air element, movement, lightness, motility. Are any of these you, identical to you? Or are they just as impersonal, devoid of person, as the earth, element, water, fire, air, in the surrounding environment? All devoid of self, of person. Equally. The space of the body, the domain, the field in which these sensations arise and pass, is that a person? Is that you? Sustaining this stillness of your own awareness, as we've done so many times before now, redirect the light of your awareness this time to the space of the mind. Identify it selectively. Focus on it single-pointedly and examine now closely. Whatever appearances arise, whatever experiences arise, anything that arises, images, thoughts, desires, emotions, anything. And whatever comes up, objectively or subjectively, examine closely. Are any of these the person that you have identified as yourself, the one who abides over time? Are they just what they seem to be? They are just thoughts, just emotions, desires with no personhood. Simply mental events, mental processes. How is it? Examine closely. Space of the mind itself. Is that a person? Is that you? Invert your awareness in upon awareness itself, as you've done so many times before. Examine closely. Awareness illuminating itself, knowing itself. And as it does so, ask this flow of awareness, is this a person? Is this me, the one who abides over time? Or is it no more than what it appears, simply a flow of cognizance, a flow of clarity, devoid of any person, any self or I? Now mentally stand back for a moment. From this whole system of the body and all the events taking place within the somatic field. And the mind and all the events that take place within that field and awareness. Stand back from the whole system and view it collectively as an integrated system. Bodily formations, mental formations, the flow of mental consciousness. And of course the derivative sensory modes of consciousness. Examine them now in their entirety, collectively. If this integrated sum total, the entire system, is that who you are? Is that a person that is you, who has abided over time? Or is it simply an impersonal system composed of impersonal parts, empty of person? Empty of you. But now probe in once again upon you, the observer, the one who is viewing, attending to the system of your body and mind. Whole system. Examine the observer. Examine the meditator. Are you anywhere to be found? Examine with precision. And arrive at certainty. Are you anywhere to be found? If you see the unfindability, if you see the absence of yourself inside the system of the body, mind, and outside, rest there. Sustain that flow of knowing. The emptiness of you. Sustain that flow of knowing, that certainty, that ascertainment with a sense of ease, stillness, and clarity. Onaso. So let's see where the Vinjan Bhaji is going to take us from here. So we'll see in the root text, he's commenting on which he's commenting. The last verse we read is, an individual is not earth, is not water, is not fire, is not air, not space, is not consciousness, is not all of them. Where then, apart from these, is the individual? So we just check that out. Also, in accordance with that, the way of the Bodhisattva, Kaita the Bodhisattva way of life, Shantideva says, so here's the very familiar litany. But rather than just kind of getting through this, he's saying this for a reason. He could have written a shorter text and said, teeth, etc. But he gave all of these. And as you know, we examine this just radically empirically and just in terms of the appearances arising to our tactile consciousness. But what he's suggesting, and the Buddha himself suggested in the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, and what Padmasambhava suggests in the Vajra Essence and elsewhere, it comes up in Buddhahood without meditation and so forth. They're doing this, I think, because they actually want us to follow along and not yawn, you know. And that is, as you consider not just the sensations of earth, water, but actually consider the body parts that certainly do exist. Just examine each one. Some people are very proud of their teeth. I know some people with just beautiful teeth, you know? They like to smile a lot. You know? And some people are very, very proud of their skin, beautiful skin. They'll take great lengths to keep the skin in really good shape. Some people, like me, are very proud of their hair. Like to show off their hair a lot, you know? Unlike those other people losing their hair. Like that. I'm not losing my hair. I'm going to have a good, full-headed corpse. Lots of hair, you know? I'm very proud of my hair. And so we identify with all kinds of things, you know. Skin, hair, teeth. Some people have beautiful eyes, then they may identify with the eyes, you know. Some people are very embarrassed by their ears. So they try to cover them over. Don't want people to see the real me. Hello, Dumbo. So we shouldn't laugh too quickly when he's going through body parts, because people do identify with body parts. People who are overweight often identify with their overweightness. They make a reference to it, and then they feel, oh, you're talking about me. Oh, and then discomfort. Some people are very skinny. Some people are very not physically and just not attractive. What can you say? You know? And so then they identify with that. They identify with bad skin. Being overweight, being underweight, having unattractive bodies and mere weight, great big feet, whatever. People are actually doing this all the time, and not just other people, you know, the non-Buddhists, the stupid ones. We really smart Buddhists, we do this too. So we can go through all the body parts and see, there are people who probably do identify with some of the things he's mentioning. Some people, I mean, people will spend hundreds of dollars, I understand, on their nails, right? Nails. And they'll say, oh, it's so nice that you dropped in. Don't tell me they're not identifying with their nails. They are. So let's take this seriously. Some people are, you know, the high cheekbones. High cheekbones. You know, some people are very proud of the high cheekbones. That look, you know. English people, I think, some English people I've heard, long heads like mine. Long heads. That's more aristocrat. Aristocrats, English aristocrats, have long heads. The people like Elizabeth, definitely not aristocrats. You know. The worker bees, the farm hands, and so they have round heads. But the aristocrats who speak like this, they have long heads. And you might be very proud of your long head. Seriously. So let's not treat this too lightly. People do. So now let's see. Just, you know, pause when you see something that you have actually identified with. Teeth? Or absence of teeth? You're walking out, you're, you know, it's nice to meet you, and you've got to cover your mouth. because you don't want to, or, you know, big empty holes. Hello. You're identifying with your teeth and your lack of teeth. It happens a lot, right? And don't get me started on mental qualities, you know? Then people identify those too. Okay, so Shantideva, illuminate us. Teeth, hair, and nails are not the self. Okay, so for all that cosmetic dentistry, all the hair salons, and all the nail, we just put them out of business. The self is not the bones or the blood. You know. Do you have aristocratic blood? You know, your bloodline. Are you from a good family? You know, what's your bloodline? Right? Are you a peasant, or are you? Do you have nobility in your blood? Oh! I met somebody, one woman in Mongolia. She was Italian, and she's telling about the popes and the other aristocrats in her family line. She was really something. I really paid much more respect for her after that. Oh, you got some blood. You got some real blood there. She looked pretty ordinary, actually. But whoa, bloodline like that. She's somebody special. She made a point of mentioning it. Contessa here, and the Pope here, and this Archduke, and so forth. I come from quite a bloodline. She had some blood. But the self is not the bones or blood. And I don't really know many people identify with the next part. It's not snot. It is not phlegm. It is not lymph. It is not pus. Although if you had a lot of those, you probably would identify with it in a very embarrassing way. The self is not fat or sweat. People can be very humiliated if they sweat a lot, right? I've seen that in advertisements, right? For underarm deodorant. And they don't dare raise armpits because people see, oh, it's wet down there. They're identifying with sweat. There's no question about it. Otherwise, why wouldn't you say, hello, it's hot. I see you've never taken this seriously before, so now you're really taking it seriously. Good. So the self is not fat or sweat, however much or little you have. It's not you. People with great lung capacity. People will pride themselves on how long they can stand under water, right? Whoa, you got some lung there. You got some. Whoa, you are an impressive person. Or people that can sing, you know, ooh, wow, she's got a pair of lungs. Yeah, liver, I guess. The lungs and liver, too, are not the self. Internal organs, too, are not the self. The self is neither, thank goodness. Excrement nor urine. But I have heard in my lifetime a person taking a really good poop and then being very proud of it. I had a really good problem this morning. You want to see? I've had wonderful teachings on pride from some of my lamas. And they say, you know, there's basically nothing that someone won't be proud about, including their stool. You name it. Some people are proud of being uneducated. George Bush commented one time when he was in college, he read a book. He said that wasn't pride. He wasn't one of those egghead, you know, knuckleheads who read lots of books. He's a man of the earth, you know, a salt of the earth. Man grounded, he read a book, he got through. And he seemed to be proud of that fact. I understand that. So heat and breath are not the self. The pores are not, nor in all their aspects are the six consciousnesses the self. The five sensory, the mental. So he just went through the whole spectrum. Yeah, that was useful. So more interesting than before, right? You didn't just whip through it. But now you see, oh, he's serious. Thus, with respect to an individual or self or I, the bone and the other earth elements of one's body, the solid parts, are not the I. The blood and other water elements, the liquid parts, are not the self. From the crown of the head to the soles of the feet, the fire element, the warm part. or the warmth, is not the self, the wind constituent of the body, shifting and moving within the channels, that clearly in my mind really shows, highlights the flow of prana, the winds, the vital energies flowing through. Very, and they are wind, they are the energy flowing through. This is not the individual. The inner hollow regions and other cavities of the body are not the individual. All consciousnesses, the I consciousness and the others, are not the self. And the self is not them. So there simply is no equivalent between yourself as a person and any of the above, individually. And then he adds, as we've just done in meditation, complete integration of theory and practice, the collection of those, everything, all the above, the collection of those is not the self. And the I is not the collection of those. So he's just going, you know, through the door from the outside in, inside out, not the same. And this I, nor is it other than those. So when we look for something outside that system, that manifold, or that aggregation of bodily and mental events, processes, nor to be found outside. For in the mind holding the idea of, now here's the working memory, right? That's the working memory, exactly what we just did. The mind holding the idea of, holding in mind. It's like having, you know, losing a dog, and you hold up, and you're walking around the neighborhood, and you hold, have you seen this dog? Have you seen this dog? Have you seen it in your house, outside your house? Please look, have you seen this dog? Have you seen any dog that looks like this dog? And if they all say no, then you're probably living in a neighborhood that's empty of your dog. Right. Not really a laughing matter, but it's pretty good. You're not just saying, have you seen a dog? But this dog. Have you seen this dog anywhere? Does this match anything you've seen in the neighborhood? Anything outside of the neighborhood? Right. That's it. You're holding something in mind, me. And very, very importantly here, you're not holding some fiction in mind, like a self-existent, immutable, partless, eternal identity, a metaphysical ego. No. There is an essential nature of the mind. You identify that when you achieve shamatha. There's the essential nature of fire. Touch it. It's hot and burning. And there is someone who does abide over time. Can you find yourself? So it's a strong parallel. It never really occurred to me before, because I've never done these two texts simultaneously. But the Vajra essence said, come to the conclusion of shamatha, you've identified the essential nature of your mind. Congratulations. And that was not an absence, that was a presence. Right? Clearly. Or as Panchen Rinpoche himself says, you've now realized the relative nature of your mind, something that does exist, not something that doesn't. And likewise, you're no more or less real than your mind or consciousness, no more or less. Right? So if fire has an essential nature, your mind has essential, your awareness has essential nature, then why not? You must have some essential nature. But again, we're not saying it's some immutable ego, substance, and so forth. It's just saying you were 5 years old a long time ago. And you were a lot of things in between. Can you find that one? So it's an interesting strategy, isn't it? Identifying and then searching for it. And the searching for it, the first one is phenomenological, the second one's ontological. Right? Phenomenologically, you can identify the essential nature of the mind. There it is, in the palm of your hand. But then you go to the engaging in the search for the mind, the ontological search. And that's where you find up. Not finding. So, for in the mind holding the idea of, in quotation, the individual who is meditating. In the mind holding that idea, holding that in working memory, there is no individual that exists as it appears. We've covered that. You appear in a myriad of ways, and many of them simply incompatible. You're really sweet and just a mean person. You're so wonderfully generous and just the stingiest person in a mile. You're very attractive and so ugly. You're so intelligent and dumb as a doornail. You know, and so forth. And they're all true. Right. And they're at least, yeah, they're all, I mean, not everybody's super attractive, but, you know, relatively speaking, sure, we have our better days and worse. And they're not the same. So we appear in a myriad of ways, as the mind appears in a myriad of ways, wholesome and unwholesome and so on, And yet we can speak of an essential nature of the mind that is abiding in all those states that are afflicted, virtuous, non-virtuous, yeah? And if the mind is, and this body, this is not somebody else's body, one could track this, there is commonality, the genes are the same, the DNA is the same, blood type is the same, there's a lot, you know, this body that's gotten older since, you know, since I was born, conceived, there's still, it's identifiable as the same body, even though the appearances are changing so much, right? So that's so interesting. I've never found this so interesting before in my life. For in the mind holding the idea of the individual's meditating, there is no individual that exists as it appears. As it appears, we can write books and books and books, volumes of the many ways I appear, sure, if anybody's interested. But is there anybody corresponding to? Is it really? Is there anybody there? Or is it all just appearances? And all of those appearances devoid of a person. Also, as stated in a sutra, form is not the self. Now we go through the five skandhas. So we started with the six elements. That's a good strategy. We just did it. Pretty good. And now the whole system, the whole explanation of the five skandhas, the five psychophysical aggregates that run through all of Buddhism, everywhere to be found in the Pali Canon. So we'll go through that. This is classic. You'll find this in the Pali Canon right here. Form, and the form is not just shape, but the form is all the physical appearances. And that's your shape, your weight, your size, all the material elements of your body, not the self. Form is not the self. Feeling, that includes both mental and sensory, somatic, and so forth, feelings. Feelings, that whole range, positive, negative, and different, you remember? Feeling is not the self. Discernment, this is that mental faculty that enables us to distinguish this from that. Discernment is not the self. Mental formations, that's a wide array of mental activities. Mental afflictions, virtuous states of mind, many, many mental factors. In fact, all of the rest of them that are not feeling and discernment, they're all in this one. This is the assembly. Mental formations, none of them, none of those mental afflictions, virtuous states, mindfulness, blah, blah, blah. None of them are the self, either individually or collectively. And then just consciousness, that sheer being aware of, whether it's visual consciousness, auditory, mental, and so on. Well, they're not a person. It's not the self. Consciousness is not the self. So there it is. Since that is the case, the five aggregates of the individual who meditates, or the six elements, or the collection of these, or the shape of the collection, none of these is the individual who meditates. Now, what he's not doing, of course, he's not saying there's no one meditating. If there's no one meditating, then there would be no point in teaching meditation to people who can never meditate. Right? He's teaching meditation, inviting you to meditate, which means you are one who meditates. So he's not going to, you know, teach you and then negate you, and, you know, like teach you and then shoot you. Teach you and then obliterate you. You know, he's not going to do, or ask you to obliterate, you know, practice meditation and then hold an ontological gun to your head and blow your brains out. He's not asking you to self-annihilate, right? You're first listening, and then you're thinking, and then you meditate. And each of those is a different manifestation. When you're just listening to teachings, that's one manifestation. You're a student, listening, right? And then you reflect upon, now you're more in the mode of a philosopher, a person who's really interested in the nature of reality. You're pondering, reflecting, analyzing, critiquing, you know, investigating. And that's a different manifestation. That's not the same as one who's simply taking it in. So you go from a student to a philosopher to a contemplative. And he's not refuting any of them. Any more than he's refuting the essential nature of the mind or the essential nature of fire. But can you be found phenomenologically? And then ontologically. None of these is the individual who meditates. His word choice is so interesting, just to my mind. If any of those five aggregates, the six elements, any of them individually or all of them collectively, if they were, then the basis of imitation, which is any of those, and the thing that you imputed, so now this crucial distinction, the basis of designation, when you say, I'm a little bit chubby, or I'm tall, or I'm calm, and so forth, we can get to continue on, you know, continue on. But when you say you're calm, the basis of designation is not the same at all as when you say you're tall or you're short. Right? It's entirely a different basis of designation. Your mind is not tall or short, and so forth. And so this is one of the very interesting factors. We don't simply have a basis of designation, you know, basis of designation on which I designate myself. It's a wide array. And it comes up when we speak about ourselves, about other people. We find, here you designated me on this, on the basis of this, and then 2 minutes later you designated me on this, and then you designated me on this, and all three of those are entirely different, without any overlap at all. And none of them are identical to the person that you designated upon those bases. You know, interesting. So if the individual were, any of those individually or collectively, if they were, then the basis of imitation and the thing imputed, the appropriated, and the appropriator, that is, I appropriated a cell phone, but in this case, the appropriated is you've taken up the meditation, and the appropriator is the one who's taken up the meditation, for example. The parts in the whole, you have many qualities. If somebody, you go for a job interview, tell me your qualifications. You probably won't just say one. Well, I'm here, aren't I? The person might say, I got that part. Anything else? You know? You'll probably tell more than one qualification. In terms of CVs, so I've been told, because I have one, the longer the better. Look at my CV. You know, many qualities. Each of which can be, oh, you're the author of that. Oh, you're the translator of that. Oh, you spoke at that conference. Oh, you held a position there. And all of those are different bases of designation with no overlap. And you show how many people there are on your CV, you know, with multiple bases of designation. So, if they were, then the basis of imitation and the thing imputed, the appropriated and the appropriator, the parts and the whole would all be one. They would be identical. If the aggregates were the self, the form, feeling, and so forth, if they were the self, identical to the self, then they would be multiple and selves would be multiple. I mean, there are five aggregates, not one. So if each of those aggregates were identical to yourself, there would be five of you. When you were born, your parents would have had quintuplets. Oh my God. Five all in the same body. Horrible. Multiple personality disorder. So that's not true. Such statements are faulty. Yep, to put it mildly. In particular, if consciousness were the individual, this is where we seem to come into the nucleus. And that is, what is it of me that abides over from year to year to year to year? Stream of consciousness that accumulates memories. It's not just an empty stream that just notes moment to moment to moment, not judgmentally. We do that occasionally, not very often. No, the stream of consciousness is like a ship that sails the seas and picks up barnacles the whole way. A lot more barnacles at the end of the voyage than before. And the older you get, the more barnacles you have. That's why we're so ugly. Barnacles all over the place. So, if the consciousness were the individual, which then really strikes home, because that is not just an appearance of this way or that way, a physical appearance, a mental mood, or attitude and so forth. That's something that continues. If consciousness were the individual, that is, if there's an equivalence, an identity there, it would be unacceptable that the individual hear, speak, see, or procreate. Have you ever seen two consciousnesses have sex? I haven't. It would kind of like, where are you? I know you're there someplace. He said it, not me. And your mental consciousness doesn't hear. Right? Mental hunt doesn't hear. Your conscious doesn't speak. Right? And it doesn't procreate, as I just said what he said. This is very sensible, because people do hear. You do hear, speak, see, and you may or may not procreate. That's your call. But you do, and consciousness doesn't. So it's just not true. As much as we might be drawn to that, well, after all, I am consciousness. No, you're not. Number one, I can see you. And don't tell me I can't see you. Then we're just speaking gibberish. If you say, no, you can't see me because I'm consciousness, then you're living in a fantasy world. I can see you and you're overweight. What do you think about that? I just proved you're not consciousness, because consciousness is never overweight. So all of the individuals singular. Yes, when your parents had you, they said it's a boy or a girl. They didn't say it's a whole bunch of boys or a whole bunch of girls. It's one. One individual, one body, one person. It's just one person. So although the individual is singular, one person, just as there are six consciousnesses, so there would be six individuals. If there's an equivalence between you and your six modes of consciousness, there'd be six of you. Conversely, just as the individual is one, so the sixth consciousness would be a partless one. And they're clearly not. They're not one. People go blind, they don't lose all of the consciousness at the same time. If the shape of the collection of elements, earth, water, and so forth, were the individual, like the gestalt, something like the gestalt of all of them, then the individual would have to be, I think that's simply a typo I haven't seen. If the shape of the collection of the elements were the individual, then the individual would be material. You would have physical form. And there would be no individuals in the formless realm. Well, that's true. So you are not form. You are not how you look. And that clearly is a serious one. A lot of people, especially, it's reinforced, massively reinforced, tragically reinforced, when people adopt a materialist view and take it seriously. Because then you are your body. I know a philosopher that says that exactly. He's a smart guy too. I don't know any unintelligent philosophers, probably, but I don't think I've met any of them. They're all very smart. This man, full professor at a major university, background in neuroscience, psychology, and philosophy of mind, smart cookie. And he says, you are your body. There's nothing more to you than your body. You're a body, you're an animal. Your body is a mammalian animal body. You are a mammalian animal body. There's nothing more to you than your body. You are that. You know, and he's written books and books. He's been, you know, very well known. Respected by his peers, among other philosophers of mind. I've been at conferences with him. I wonder if they really follow the implications of what they're saying and how utterly savage that is. Because that means just some people are beautiful and some people are ugly. And I don't mean their bodies, I mean them. You know? Because, I mean, it's equivalence. If your body is ugly, then you're an ugly person. But we know that's not true. The people have, you know, unattractive forms, and they're just some of the loveliest people you ever meet. And there's some people who are just drop-dead gorgeous, and you just can't bear to be with them. Just because their personalities, their way of behavior, just like, oh, can I go now? You know, we know it's not true. But in our materialistic society, it's the emphasis. How does the brain generate this? How does the brain do that? You are a brain carrying a body on your back, says one of the most authoritative neuroscientists in the United States. You're a brain carrying a body in your back. It means if you're brain damaged, then you are a damaged person. Not that you have an affliction. You are damaged. Yeah. So I find that really not only profoundly false, but so tragically misleading to equate a person with a body, which is very widely done now. And then, of course, then you know you're in a losing game, because nobody gets more and more attractive as you get older and older and older. Maybe up to age 20 or so, but then after that, 25, 30, 30 is the cutoff, isn't it? That's where we just all start looking uglier. And then, whether male or female, we try to, you know, oh, you look, you haven't aged a bit. Thank God. I tricked them. All that money I spent, it was worth it. They think I'm 10 years younger than I am. Oh, pitter-pat goes my heart. Thank goodness that's not true. So, nor is the individual separate from. So we see the individual is not identical with any of the five aggregates individually, not to them collectively. Nor is the individual separate from the aggregates, as we just did in the meditation. You look for yourself, okay, here's this whole matrix of mind-body events arising, including consciousness, including mental consciousness. That's one of the aggregates. And then you try to step outside and say, am I, since I'm clearly not any of them individually or collectively, the only other place I could be is outside. If I'm not inside the aggregates, if the dog is not inside the neighborhood, it's got to be outside the neighborhood. If it's not inside the neighborhood or outside the neighborhood, your dog doesn't exist anymore. I mean, that's straight logic. You've lost your dog. It's in this neighborhood. It's outside the neighborhood. If it's neither one, your dog no longer alive. I'm sorry, but the dog is nowhere to be found. It doesn't exist anymore. And so here we are. Isn't the individual not separate from the aggregates? If it were, it would exist as inherently unconnected and separate. And that is, your body would get old, you wouldn't get old, your mind would get agitated, you don't. And so forth and so on. All the characteristics of your body and mind would not apply to you. In fact, you would have no characteristics, except you would simply be the owner. The absentee owner and manager. It's like one of those, some kind of a corporation. Overseas corporation. This is a phantom corporation. Right? And you look for, who's the CEO? Where's the board? Because it's registered, it exists, and money is going into it. And then you're looking, where is it? Where's its headquarters? Where's its board? I want to meet the director. And then you can't find it. It's one of those things on the books, tax dodge. So, if it were to be, it would exist as inherently unconnected and separate, so the collection of aggregates would not possess the characteristics that the collection of the aggregates would not possess the characteristics that define the aggregates. It is said, if it were separate from the aggregates, then it would not have the characteristics of the aggregates. So all the qualities of your body, mind, and your behavior would not be your qualities. And then you say, well, tell me your qualities, and then you just wind up with nothing to say. Also, there would be the fault taught in the sutra on the elephant's exertion. I don't know the sutra, but it's going to be interesting. If phenomena existed inherently, the conquerors, that's the jhanas, and the shravakas would know it. This is speaking within the Buddhist fold, you know. These are the people within the context of Buddhism where we have faith, we have respect, we have reverence. We regard some people as really knowing what's going on, the Buddhas, the Shravakas, the Arya Bodhisattvas. If phenomena did exist inherently, then the Buddha would know about it, or the Buddhas would know about it, the Shravakas would know about it. Okay. And it's similar like in the context of physics. I mean, there are authorities in physics, right? Brilliant physicists. And so if a planet had been discovered, an exoplanet had been discovered, in which life was found, well, you'd know who to ask. You'd go to Cambridge, you'd go to the MIT, you'd go to Caltech, you'd go to other, you know, major, major institutes that have outstanding astronomy departments. If it has been discovered, they would know about it, right? The leading astronomers would know about it. If they don't know about it, then this has to be a fantasy. Right? That's what he's saying. In Buddhist context, these are our experts. And so if they did exist, well, the Buddha would have known about it. Shravakas would have known about it. Immutable phenomena would never transcend suffering. And that's by implication, you've heard it before. If phenomena were to exist inherently, they would exist independently of everything around them, which means they'd be uninfluenced by everything around them, which means they would be uninfluenced altogether, and therefore immutable. And if you were immutable, you would never transcend suffering. And the wise would never be free from conceptual elaborations, because we'd all be stuck, we'd all be static, frozen. Thus, when you examine with a subtle consciousness, oh, here we are again, from within equipoise. So he's tying these together in such a clear, crisp way. He taught shamatha first, he's teaching vipassana first, and he's saying shamatha is your foundation, your platform, your basis. You now have dissolved your coarse flow of mental consciousness into an underlying subtle continuum, which is much clearer, sharper, supple, malleable, serviceable. And it's balanced. That's where contemplative objectivity comes in. It's balanced from in this equipoise, right? So when you examine with this refined consciousness from within a state of meditative equipoise, you yourself appear such that not even an atom exists of the individual or self or person who's resting in equipoise. Okay, we seek to approximate this when we're practicing, for example, settling the mind in its natural state. We're seeking to approximate the perspective of having achieved shamatha already, and from that transpersonal, because it's not embedded in your personality, right? Your language, your personal history, and so forth. It's seeking that stillness of awareness to view the mind as if from afar. You remember that? And all those metaphors used, like watching a spectacle, as if from afar, like the old man watching children play, not in the midst of the children playing, not grazing with the sheep, not caught up inside the spectacle and so forth. You're not a performer. You're the audience, right? And now he's saying, okay, if you've achieved shamatha, that's exactly now, from that perspective, you examine yourself. The specimen from this transpersonal perspective that's not embedded in your personality and all of that. And so how do you appear to yourself? So the meditation we just did, now imagine having done the same meditation from having achieved shamatha. That's what he's referring to here. Right? Same meditation, though. You yourselves appear such that not even an atom exists of the individual or self or person who is resting in meditative equipoise. You find, when you seek to establish yourself, how do I actually exist? Where am I to be found? Not even an atom. All of a sudden there is emptiness. As you are seeking, so again, optimally we would have done that meditation we just finished earlier this session, from the perspective of resting in the substrate consciousness, but then activating, not just sitting there, and then engaging in this, and that not finding the meditator, the self, the person, and in that not finding, that final moment when there's only one more possibility, maybe I exist outside the manifold. Not. That was the final straw that broke the back of reification. Right? It's that decisiveness. Now it's not to be found. Right? If somehow you lost your dog and you could know decisively, I don't know how this would occur, a thought experiment, you've checked thoroughly in your neighborhood, nowhere to be found, and if somehow you could check equally thoroughly outside your neighborhood, maybe you live in a village in the midst of the Sahara or out in the Gobi Desert where it's pretty empty around there, right? You might be able to decisively know the dog's not out there. I know the dog's not out there. And I know the dog's not in our little oasis here. I know my dog is not to be found. I'll stop looking now. Right? It's that certainty that if it could have been found, I would have found it. I didn't. Therefore, I discovered something not to be found. Suddenly, there's emptiness. When the generic idea, I think it's more of an idea than an image, when the generic idea of that clear vacuity, that sheer emptiness, is clear in your mind, it's an idea. Bear in mind, he's speaking progressively here, where your realization of an emptiness is first by way of a generic idea, and then as you go deeper, 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 the cloud of the generic idea that brought you to the right direction evaporates, and then you have that direct realization of emptiness free of the mediation of any generic idea. But in the Gelugpa tradition, very clearly, and I think there's every reason to believe it's true, when you first gain some realization, unless you're an exceptional individual like a Bahia or someone like that, when you first gain some genuine insight, that insight will be filtered through, enabled by a generic idea. That is, your insight will be a conceptual insight. You look for your dog. It's not in the neighborhood. It's not outside. And say, my dog's not there. Well, what is the mind that just now knows your dog isn't there, is nowhere to be found? It's a conceptual mind. And there arises in your mind a sheer absence of the dog. The image, sheer absence, my dog is nowhere to be found. And it's a conceptual mind that knows that. And you know something is true. Your dog isn't there. That's not a concept. It's reality. The dog's not there anymore. Right? But you know it by way of, my dog isn't to be found. It's like that, like, oh. Like that. It's a shock. When the generic idea of that clear vacuity is clear in your mind, then without further mental elaboration, don't keep on cogitating. Just come to that point. You've just come to an incisive moment of knowing without further mental elaboration, not bringing anything to mind, don't add anything to it. You rest in single-pointed equipoise. Now, of course, if you've shiv shamata, you might be able to rest for minutes and minutes on end, right? Without your mind just, you know, losing the target and wandering off. If your apprehension of that clear vacuity, which is a simple negation, if your apprehension of that, your knowing of it, weakens a bit, it weakens a little, you get fuzzy, nebulous, fading out, like drifting off a radio station and just kind of going into static. If it weakens a little, then meditate single-pointedly from within equipoise. Don't fall into excitation or laxity. Go right back to your equipoise and then examine as before. Examining as before, that is the way to maintain the mind in space-like equipoise. So that's what meditation on emptiness is called. It's called when you are in meditation and engaging this ontological probe, when you come to that point of not finding and seeing the unfindability, then there's just this openness, this spaciousness. All of a sudden there is emptiness. That's called the space-like meditative equipoise. It is taught that when you first ascertain things in this way, if you're not already familiar with the view, fear will arise if you are acquainted with it. Joy will arise. That's a very profound point. And it's based on an enormous amount of experience. It means centuries of experience. It's why, among the Bodhisattva precepts, one of them is don't teach emptiness to those who are not ready. They'll very easily, and almost certainly, fall into nihilism. I had a correspondence not too long ago with someone who was, I'm going to keep it totally vague, but he'd listened to a talk that I'd given on emptiness and how phenomena arise always relative to a perspective. And he made it very clear that his understanding was, that means that whatever you believe, that's your reality. You just make it up as you go. If you don't like global warming, well, then just think it's not true. And in fact, every time he summarized, or he said some people could think, he completely missed the point. Not an unintelligent person by any means. I thought, oh, that's interesting. I never saw that coming, that you would so completely miss everything I was saying, and completely miss everything that John Wheeler and Stephen Hawking and Andre Lind were saying, that you would completely miss it. Didn't see that coming. I was surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if there was somebody kind of like, you know, mentally dull, unintelligent, uneducated. That was not true at all. Everything the opposite. Highly educated, very, very bright. But not familiar with this view. That was just that simple. That is not a sign of lack of intelligence. Just not familiar with the view. Right? And then, not familiar with the view, you hear it and you immediately get it wrong. And so it's either a hippie's world, like, it's your reality, man, you know, something completely ridiculous. As if that's what Nagarjuna was getting at. And John Wheeler, they're just a bunch of hippies saying, well, it's your reality, man. You know, well, there's completely silly. Or the more likely one, if you're not familiar with the view, if you're not prepared, you'll do this and very understandably come to the conclusion, I don't exist at all. I thought I did. You set me up to think I did. I thought I'd identified myself. And you just showed me that it was completely wrong. Because if I do exist, I should be within the system of body-mind, somewhere, collectively. I should be the whole system or something. Or I should be outside owning it, like a, you know, like immortal soul, owning my body and mind. But you've just shown me I don't exist at all. Thanks a million. And that was a bit sarcastic, but it can be really, if one takes this to heart, it can be very, very frightening. There's a very well-known story. I must have heard it from Geshe Gyaltsa. I think so. He told us so many good stories. Tell me whether you remember this from him, Kathy. It was a monk from Nartang. It's an old, I've told this story many times, but it was from a long time ago. A monk, Nartang is a region of Tibet, during the time of Tsongkhapa, and this monk was listening to a discourse by Tsongkhapa on emptiness. And Tsongkhapa, of course, speaking with from profound realization, which, just like if you listen to a bodhisattva speaking about it, about bodhicitta, it has a big impact, right? And likewise for other things. Well, if you listen to a person who has profound realization of emptiness, and you're listening with open heart, open mind, you're really attentive, those words are going to have a lot of power. It's not going to be just information transfer. There's going to be some real power behind that. Tsongkhapa was such an individual. In addition, he's just an incredibly powerful intellect. You know, so the two together. So Tsongkhapa was giving these teachings on the lack of existence, the absence of a self, of a person, that very emptiness. And as this monk from Nartang, the region of Nartang, was listening very astutely, very openly, then he suddenly, then he suddenly jerked and grabbed his collar, like that, like freaking out. And Tsongkhapa was clairvoyant, and he saw this monk. There were probably many monks there, but he picked him out, because he saw this guy, like that. And Tsongkhapa commented, ah, the monk from Nartang has just established his conventional identity on the basis of his collar. That he had the sense that, I don't exist at all. Oh, I have a collar, therefore I am. You know, conventionally. Which was good. Because it's not true that he doesn't exist at all. And it is true that he has a collar. And that's how he established it. So shamatha is no joking matter. Some of you have experienced, and I've taught it for a long time, I know a lot of people. People practice shamatha, they start going deep. And they can experience, bump into some very deep fear. And it's just very simply put, the fear, when it doesn't have a clear object, right? It's a fear of total annihilation. That if I continue down this track, I'm going to slip into a vacuity, a void, an emptiness, and there'll be no coming back because I will have disappeared and I will be annihilated. And that's no laughing matter. And so fear comes up. I've seen it happen. In one case, it was so strong, it basically disabled the person's meditation. They couldn't go back. So no laughing matter. And that's just shamatha. Right. Well, this is deeper. This is much deeper. So, that's for the meditative state. I think that was really quite extraordinary to my mind. He just described what you do on the cushion and what is bound to arise. And when he says familiar with the view, it's not only are you a good scholar, have you learned about it and so forth, but have you paired, this is a very nice point to end on because we're coming to our day off on Saturday. But here's another important element pertaining to the story with this monk from Nartang. This really, really crucial point. I'll say something you're familiar with, and that is if you have an authentic insight into emptiness, not slipping into your familiar substantialism or terrifying nihilism, but you found that slender middle way, that's what's left over when you're free of extremes. And in the very seeing of the emptiness of yourself, you see by the power of that how you and all other sentient beings arise in mutual interdependence. Then that very vision, that very insight into emptiness will enhance your compassion. Insofar as I regard myself and truly believe that I exist independently, autonomously, the real me over here, what that immediately implies is I really don't have any relationship with you or with anybody, not even my father who's still alive or my siblings or my friends, my family, my spouse, my grandson, and so on. No relationship. Because I don't have a relationship with anything or anyone because I'm a self-made man. I stand on my own. I'm an independent. I am who I am. And you are who you are. Good luck. So that grasping to self, that's the one that actually undermines any sense of empathy compassion, bodhicitta. It devastates it. It nukes it, right? Because everybody is, rather than all sentient beings being your mothers, all sentient beings are strangers. Unrelated. The other side of the fence. Right? And it's very lonely. It's very lonely. Very isolated. Very alienated. And I see this, I think this crops up on occasion. You know, where people take it seriously. Let alone materialism makes it all the worse. Can you imagine? Think you're inherently existent and you're just chemical scum? How about that, to be inherently existent chemical scum? That's bleak on top of bleak. That's just devastating. That should be criminal. I don't want to put anybody in jail, but what a horrific thing to say to people. I mean, just horrific. What could be worse than that? And so there's the way of isolation, loneliness, despair, and nihilism. And ironically, realizing the emptying of yourself and realizing what is the self that's empty, and then how do I exist? I do exist from moment to moment, arising in a myriad of ways. Here I'm a grandfather, here I'm a teacher, here I'm a spouse, here I'm a customer, here I'm an employer, here I'm a vacationer, here I'm a traveler, here I am, here I am. All just a show, all empty. And all interrelated, because I can't be any of those things. Not one that I just mentioned. I can't be any of those things without relationship to who's your grandchild, grandpa? Who's your grandchild? Oh, I don't have any grandchild. Well, then you're not a grandpa. No grandchildren, no grandpa. And so forth and so on. But every one of them, they're all relational. Which means we're all intertwined. Our very existence, our very being is one of interdependence. And then how can we not care for the other? As Shantideva, he has so many verses that just go to the heart. But when he's struggling with the issue, do I really need to take upon myself the responsibility for others? And you remember, I've told this story many, many times. But do I really need to take on my shoulders the burden of the world? That great compassion, great loving kindness. So do I really need to? Because it sounds just absolutely cosmically overwhelming, you know, rather than just being able to slip off quietly and become an arhat and disappear, you know, just quietly, go off screen. And do I really need to? Is that really necessary? He poses the question to himself, and the answer comes back, yes, you do. Yes, you do. You do need to take that responsibility. And then the question comes back, why? And the answer comes back, because suffering has no owner. Really powerful, yeah. Because suffering has no owner. Just that. So, then you can see how the method and the wisdom, the more deeply you've been cultivating great compassion, great loving kindness, cultivating bodhicitta, cultivating the four measurables for that matter, the more that you are attending to others and they're becoming real for you, the interdependence between self and other becomes real for you, real for you. The more you're exchanging yourself for others, valuing others' well-being more than your own, the more you're taking the lower position, as in the eight verses of training mind, in all circumstances, take the lowest position. Remember? The first teaching, first public teaching His Holiness gave in the West. 8 verses, training of mind. Yeah. And the author says, in all situations, take the lowest position. Right. So if you're accustomed to that, you know, accustomed to that, and then you go into this practice and you realize, I am nowhere to be found. My body empty, mind empty, nowhere to be found, empty. What a relief. Joy will arise. Because there's this one burden you're still carrying with you. I am. As someone separate. So if you're acquainted with it, joy will arise. So such people following the Bodhisattva way, they should be taught. They should be taught bodhicitta. And they should be taught emptiness, I should say. They should be taught teaching and emptiness. Because it will bring them joy. So, that's that. That should keep you busy for a day. Enjoy your weekend.